All right, so today's lesson is actually going to be one that's mostly an exercise. Starting next week, the more formal sort of lectures and discussions are going to happen as we begin first with a couple of units on the history of technology, its relationship to medicine, and then as we jump quite drastically for the remainder of the semester, focusing on digital media and its place in medical and clinical practice right now. But for today, what I wanted to do was sort of have a little bit of a primer on what does media studies look like? What does it mean to look at media texts, and what kind of questions do we ask of media, not just digital, but media more generally? To that end, I've made some handouts of some kinds of questions and some principles that really shape what media studies is about in its most broad sense. And then we're going to look at maybe four or five different examples today, collectively in a group, and at one occasion breaking into small groups of looking at examples to see what does it mean to study different kinds of media. So let me start with these handouts. So let's take one of these each, everybody. And one of these as well. These will all be available on Blackboard after class. And so will the syllabus, by the way, too. Sorry for the delay on that front, but... Okay. Let's look at these two handouts. And this will give us a little bit of the kinds of questions and the kinds of discourses that inform what media studies looks like. Today is the day to be asking all kinds of questions, to be saying, is this a reasonable question to ask of a digital media? It's really to use this day as providing us almost with the cheat sheet for what sort of is the toolbook that we're going to be using semester long. To that end, let's look at this first page, which is called Some Key Principles of Media Studies. Does everybody know what we mean when we say media, by the way? What definitions do we think of when we say the word media? Yeah.
It's like a form of mass communication to the public.
Yes.
It's a, I guess some type of service industry whose major goal is to relay information to a society on a grand scale or a large scale.
Good. You've given me about four different examples there, which is to say something intended for a mass audience, something meant to relay information, something meant to communicate. Anybody else definitions that we have here? I'm going to write some of these down.
This is basically the question of what does media look like? So, mass audience, and by the way, what constitutes mass can totally be different in different circumstances, right? Relay of information, in some ways any product that's relaying information sometimes falls into the group of media. What else? Communication, which is like the one above it, but it's another term that we use. Entertainment often falls within media studies, modes of entertainment. What else? Yeah?
Media is a field which deals with the content, history.
Content, history? I mean, another definition of media that we often have is when we refer to the media, which is to say journalism or something. So that which is current or what is news we consider to be media, in contrast to your example of history there. And I think another example would be instead of mass audience, I might say mass education. So in other words, how is there a pedagogical sort of component to what media is doing? Does media inform? Does media entertain? Does media educate? How is it doing sometimes more than one of these functions is sort of a way to start with. In other words, when we're talking about media, we're really talking about discourse, discussion. We're talking about tangible, that definition of tangible, kind of different meanings, tangible things that are used to contribute to mass discourse. That's basically what media is. So it can be a public radio broadcast. It can be a website. It can be a newspaper that you pick up at the newsstand. It can be Entertainment Tonight. It can be a film. It can be any sort of one of these kinds of products that serves many different sorts of purposes, but basically one that contributes to cultural mass sort of discourse in some way. So turning to this handout, let's look at some of the key principles of media studies. The first is media audiences.
who is watching is what the phrase is used here, or how our audience is identified, constructed, addressed, and reached, how audiences find and choose to consume and respond to media texts. So because we know that media, at its most fundamental, widest definition, is about thinking about a mass audience, the first question we can almost always ask of any text that we're studying is, who is this intended for? Who is the audience here? And it may be a tough question to answer, and it may be a question that has many answers, but it's certainly an interesting place to start to think about who is the audience with which this media is determined. After all, many things that can be considered personal and private become media when the media are made public in some degree. So think of that shift that happens when we have an audience. You need to have an audience in some way for it to be constituted media. Media technologies. How do they do the kind of work they do? What kind of technologies are available to whom? How to use them? The differences they make to the production process as well as the final product. In other words, what is the thing? What is the technology that is making possible media in this particular case? Which is to say that media as a definition, as a category, seems to have two requirements almost in some degree, prerequisites. And one is an audience, and the second is a technology. So when you unite technology with mass audience, that's what media is. Now that technology can be a newspaper, that technology can be a megaphone or something as basic as that, but that's what makes it media. So you take technology and you combine it to mass audience. So asking those two questions first and foremost is, what technology are we working with and who's the audience we're talking about? Other things to think about are media agencies and ownership, who produces the text, who owns it, the roles that are made. This is a significant thing to think about, and who is the audience, this is saying who is the author, who has written this, who is the person that's disseminating this, from what site or what source is this information coming out. So in that relationship of message that is sent to receiver, we need to know where the message is supposed to land, the audience, but we also need to know where it's launched from at the same time. So, and that can look very different in different ways. So the megaphone is down the hall and it is Thomas who is talking into it, versus this is an article that appeared in this newspaper owned by the Robert Murdoch Association, published in conjunction with yada yada yada. But asking those kinds of questions is important. Media languages. This doesn't mean just literally, was it in French or Spanglish or whatever, but rather it means, what is the discourse, what is the subtlety in the language that's happening here? For those of you who have a background in any kind of cultural or literary studies, this is a moment we might call the close reading moment. Like, I see the words that are given to me, let me look at them more closely. How is it interesting that this word instead of that word was used? Or how is this font instead of that font used? And bearing those kinds of questions in mind allows us to register subtlety that's happening in the messages. Media categories, this is just a place to simply say genre. What category of media does this fall into? That may seem like it's just a sort of technically categorical kind of question to ask, but it's actually significant. If you can isolate what the genre of what you're working with is, it can absolutely shape the way you interpret it and the way you know that it's going to be intended or understood in culture. So for our sake, semester long, thinking about if something feels ethical or unethical in its relationship to clinical practice as a piece of media, it could very well have a very different ethical weight on it if it says, well, this is actually a piece of media that comes out as an educational tool from the NIH versus, well, you know, this is just an editorial in the LA Times, you know? The exact same thing can have an absolutely different ethical sort of weight depending on the genre. So being able to name what the genre is essential. And lastly is media representation, and this is sort of the umbrella one for how is this representation happening? Is there stereotyping, or are there consequences, or are there ethical sort of concerns that are happening here? Any questions about this? This is all very kind of overarching and sort of generic, but nevertheless, sort of what governs and what guides media studies. I've abbreviated with some questions here on the second handout I gave you. And this might be a good thing to keep on the table in front of you today. And it might be a good idea, I think, for you to have to just keep at some place handy for you semester long to refer to. So if you've got a notebook, tape it on the inside, or if you've got a, you know, on your notebook or a notepad or iPad or whatever, you know, keep a copy of it. And that's to say, these are things to ask about media that we are studying, and they include, for whom is this intended? By whom was this produced? To what effect and what intention was it disseminated or created? And that's hard to read, because one can't read into one's mind one's intention, but it's worth asking. With what unintended side effects could have happened? Where is this media existing? And that can be many locations. So for example, we might ask of ourselves, especially in the age of the internet, which is going to be a common feature for us semester long, you know, this article appeared in the Poughkeepsie Times 12 weeks ago. Having said that, now it's now gone viral, and so the wear impact of it is actually complicated and exacerbated. In context and out of context, how do we understand this media that we're studying? In its historical moment, whether that be 100 years ago, last week, or 5 minutes ago, what does it mean to look at digital media in its place in the future and in posterity? How to ask these questions. Again, I'm going through all of this to give us a sort of playbook for what we're basically doing the rest of class, which is to start looking at stuff. Any questions about those questions, I guess? Okay, for today, we're going to be doing four things. It's actually, we're going to be doing five. I decided to add an extra one. The first thing we're going to do is look at a photograph together. Controversial one, one you might be familiar with, and we're going to see how does this photograph speak to some of these very dilemmas and questions that have been set forward here for us at the beginning of the class. Secondly, I want us to listen to a radio broadcast, a famous radio broadcast, and to listen to what does it mean and what does it affect how we understand it in posterity, but also what it would have been like in this particular moment, and that it's on radio in particular. The third thing that's listed as number two here is we're going to break into small groups. Jamie, you probably remember this from the other class. We're going to talk about public health posters and to think about them as a particular genre of media that operates within medicine and culture and think about how they work. That we're going to do in small groups and come back together and share ideas. And then the last thing we're going to do is just going to look at a couple of examples together. One is a piece of print journalism. And the last is to look at a piece of television footage. Hopefully what we're going to find over the course of the day today is that a lot of the kinds of questions we can ask of different forms of media, digital or otherwise, are consistent, are enduring across different genres and different types of media. And other times we're going to find that these are very specific concerns to specific kinds of media in particular. So any questions before we start? Okay. So everybody take one of these. Like I said, many of you will probably know this photograph. This is a famous photograph that was taken on 9/11 by the photographer. It's a German photographer, Austrian, Thomas Hopkor. He takes lots of photos for the Associated Press and CNN and German newspapers and such. This is a photograph that he didn't have released after he first took it after 9/11, but he did later have it released, and this is an editorial that he wrote for Slate magazine. I want us to take a look at the photograph first, so if, even though I'm passing out this editorial, let's hold off on reading it just yet, because I want us to just look at the photograph and judge it on its own sort of concerns at first. And then we're going to read his editorial and talk a bit more about the context of the photo. How many of you had seen this photograph before? Does anybody remember when it first came to light? I mean, it was definitely years after 9/11, but I can't remember when. Do you remember, anybody? All right, we'll find that, I suppose, in the editorial. But anyway, looking at the photograph, somebody describe what we're looking at here. Anybody?
Well, it's sort of, I mean, aside from the background, it's sort of a nice, like, summery scene. It looks like five people hanging out, having a good time in the sun. And
yeah.
In the background, there's also, like, obviously the horrific events of 9/11.
Right. I mean, it's a photograph that it was controversial even when it was released years after 9/11 because of the way that it seems to send a message that could be read as almost incendiary in its aloofness, almost, might be a way to describe it. So obviously this is taken from, I think it's Brooklyn or someplace like that, looking over at the Manhattan skyline as the towers are burning, and we're assuming both of them haven't fallen yet, but certainly it's in the day when these events are happening on 9/11. Let's talk about some of the questions that I said shape media studies and what they are for. And the first I said would have been audience and then technology. Let's just start with technology first. What is the technology we have that lends this photo or this image media worthy?
Color photography.
Color photography, absolutely. And depending on where this image is printed or disseminated, that also means digital technology and photography on computer screens, that means newspapers, that means print imagery. So the fact that this photo has a different sense of weight and perhaps ethical offense if we've seen it on a computer screen and can turn the page, or whether it's in print in front of us in a magazine, or whether that feels like either one of those. And we're going to find out a lot this semester, especially about the question of digital. Does digital media render the ethical concerns of certain types of media more permanent or more impermanent? Is the media or the internet a site where things are there forever, or things are gone and disappear in a second into the ether? After all, a photograph that's in a newspaper or a magazine or a book feels far much more tangible. A photograph that can be found in a book in the library in some ways might offend me more than a photograph that's on the internet. Having said that, on the internet it's just a click away from being in everybody's inbox in 5 seconds, right? And you think having disappeared, but somebody unearthing later. So, in some ways, the internet has not resolved the problem of permanence or impermanence of media. It's only made it different, or maybe more complicated. So, but having said that, this photograph plays exactly into that. It was withheld from being printed at first because of the fear that it would be send the wrong message. Not just by these people in the photograph, but perhaps by the photographer himself. You know, I might come across as being somebody that's capitalizing on tragedy for the sake of just getting airtime, if you will, in a publication. So the who is at the center of this matter is not just the people in the photograph, but the man who took the photograph and all of the people that are affected by what is in the background of this photograph as well. Those are the who that surround this particular picture. So the technologies here are sort of many. And the audience for this photograph? It's hard to say in the sense that it was withheld from publication. If something is withheld from publication, there is an implied knowledge there that somebody wants to prevent an audience from receiving this particular photograph. So to that degree, even though there is a kind of curtailing or reining in of what that dissemination of this photograph was, there was an intended audience, and that probably would have been just a mass readership or a mass audience, or people that would have been affected by that, or we could say an American audience in some degrees. I wonder if part of the hesitation to release this photograph had as much to do with the fact that it might be snubbing its nose, not just at 9/11, but patriotism in some way by having it released. Before we ask some more questions about it, let's take a look at this editorial that we have here from Thomas Hopfker. Okay. So I took that 9/11 photo Frank Rich wrote about, is basically what this editorial that he wrote is titled, which is a very eloquent title, I must say, right? So here we go. On Sunday, September the 10th, looks like it's 2006, if it says at the top, Frank Rich of the New York Times wrote a column about a shocking 9/11 photograph by Thomas Hopfker. The picture, which was taken on the Brooklyn waterfront the afternoon of 9/11, is reproduced here. On Tuesday, Slate's David Plotz criticized Rich's analysis of the photo. Yesterday, one of the people in the picture, Walter Sipser, wrote to Slate to take issue with Rich and Hopfker's interpretations. Today, the photographer himself joins the debate. Hopfker is a photographer with the documentary cooperative Magnum Photos. Some of his other 9/11 pictures can be seen in this Magnum Slate interactive feature. Incidentally, Slate mailed Rich yesterday inviting him to respond, but we have not heard back from him. Here we go. This is Hopfker writing. Now that a broad discussion has opened up about a photograph that I took on September 11th on the waterfront in Brooklyn, I think I should add my voice and view on the event. This image happened in passing, so to speak, when I tried to make my way down to southern Manhattan on the morning of 9/11. I live on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, and being a seasoned photojournalist, I followed my professional instinct, trying hard to get as close as possible to the horrendous event. When I heard that the subway had stopped running, I took out the car only to get stuck immediately in traffic on 2nd Avenue. I took my chances by crossing the Queensboro Bridge. Then, turning south into Queens and Brooklyn, I stayed close to the East River, stopping here and there to shoot views of the distant catastrophe which unfolded on the horizon to my right. The car radio provided horrific news nonstop. The second tower of the World Trade Center had just imploded. Estimates of more than 20,000 deaths were quoted and later discredited. Somewhere in Williamsburg, I saw out of the corner of my eye an almost idyllic scene near a restaurant. Flowers, cypress trees, a group of young people sitting in the bright sunshine of this splendid late summer day, while the dark, thick plume of smoke was rising in the background. I got out of the car, shot 3 frames of the seemingly peaceful setting, and drove on hastily, hoping, fearing to get closer to the unimaginable horrors at the tip of Manhattan. The next day, I went to the office of my agency, Magnum Photos. There, on the light tables and computer screens, were hundreds of touching, shocking, and moving images that my colleagues had taken at or near Ground Zero. We quickly decided to publish a book, and I took boxes of pictures home to start working on a selection and a first layout. I chose 3 of my own shots that I had taken from the Manhattan Bridge, but set the images from that idyllic scene in Williamsburg aside, feeling that they did not reflect at all what had transpired on that day. The picture, I felt, was ambiguous and confusing. Publishing it might distort the reality as we had felt it on that historic day. I had seen and read about the outpouring of compassion of New Yorkers toward the sick and stricken families, the acts of heroism by firefighters, police, and anonymous helpers. This shot didn't feel right at this moment, and I put it in the B box of rejected images. Now, in 2006, David Friend, in his book Watching the World Change, wrote that I had self-censored the picture. At the time, we did actually use a similar picture in the Magnum book, a shot by my friend and colleague Alex Webb, which shows a mother bending down to her baby in a cart on a roof in Brooklyn with the column of smoke in the background. It has a similar life goes on quality, but there is a tenderness to the image that is lacking in my shot. 4.5 years later, when I was going through my archive to assemble a retrospective exhibition of my work from more than 50 years, the color slide from Brooklyn suddenly seemed to jump at me. Now, distanced from the actual event, the picture seemed strange and surreal. It asked questions but provided no answers. How could disaster descend on such a beautiful day? How could this group of cool-looking young people sit there so relaxed and seemingly untouched by the mother of all catastrophes which unfolded in the background? Was this the callousness of a generation which had seen too much CNN and too many horror movies? Or was it just the devious lie of a snapshot which ignored the seconds before and after I had clicked the shutter? Maybe this group had just gone through agony and catharsis or a long, concerned discussion. Was everyone supposed to run around with a worried look on that day or the weeks after 9/11? How would I have looked on that day to a distance observer? Probably like a cold-hearted reporter geared to shoot the pictures of his life. I just remember that I was in shock, confused, scared, disoriented, and emotional, but trying hard to stay focused on getting my snaps. The picture ended up on a wall of my retrospective exhibition in my hometown, Munich, together with 200 of my images, and it made the cover of my book, which accompanied the show. When I did guided tours through the exhibition, people stopped and kept asking endless questions about it, questions for which I didn't have pat answers. Then the press came. They, too, asked many questions. The image has been published in 15 newspapers in Germany, but only once in the United States, as a half page in David Friend's book on the images of 9/11. But it has now come to the surface through 3 paragraphs in the New York Times written by Frank Ridge last Sunday. These thoughtful words, without the picture, were enough to incite a debate which has swept over to Slate that has just started and seems to grow by the hour on the internet and many blogs. I think the image has touched many people exactly because it remains fuzzy and ambiguous in all its sun-drenched sharpness. On that five years ago, sheer horror came to New York, bright and colorful like a Hitchcock movie, and the only cloud in that blue sky was the sinister first smoke signal of a new era. All right, having read the editorial by the photographer, do you agree with his assessment of the photograph? Let's start there. Its fuzziness, he says, its ambiguity, its sun-drenched something or other, he said, sharpness. What do you make of that? Do you agree? Would you describe the photo as ambiguous? Be honest.
Yes, I think I can, because this photo shows the very huge smoke, but others are just sitting with us and they're not worried and they're just like nothing is happening.
I mean, it seems to be like, is this what apathy looks like? Or is this what a lack of interest looks like? I take a little issue with his use of the word ambiguous, though, in the sense that ambiguous seems to me to be rather innocent or seems to be rather aloof in the way that the photo, but this photo strikes me as less ambiguous than a word to use would be loaded. It seems to me that this image could be offensive. And its offensiveness could come from not the ambiguity in the photo, but the contradiction. Might be a better word to use there, you know?
If you took your hand and covered up just the top,
yeah,
just the bottom,
yeah,
you would never have put those two halves together.
And I'll tell you, when it comes to what technology is at work here, I think part of the reason that photo didn't come out right away is that someone would, first question what they would ask would be, was this photoshopped? Yeah, was it real? Did that happen? Did someone take a picture of Brooklyn last week with the people at the bottom and then take one that morning and just splice it? Because I don't know Photoshop well, and I could do it in a second and it would look just like it was real, you know? One has to ask, is this a real photo? Is it manipulated? It's an interesting question to ask, one we're going to talk about more later this semester. We all know that Photoshop exists. So whatever trust we had in photography is gone a little bit now, because we look at things and we question, is this a real or is it a fake, you know, in some way. The truth of the matter is photography has always been an unreliable sort of image. It seems to take truth as it takes a photo, but manipulation of photography is as old as photography itself. So that question, is this a real photo, has sort of always existed. It's just Photoshopped has made it even trickier to sort of figure that out. Other questions, other insights about this photograph? What ways does it offend? And you can use specific examples. You know, for example, if I was the wife of a firefighter on that day, ..
My sort of gut feeling as I look at this is not that I'm necessarily offended by these people in the picture, because I feel like it's so inconceivable that they could be feeling the way it looks like they're feeling, I guess, in
yeah,
the situation. That I'm more sort of offended, like, sort of right off the bat, just from looking at the picture, I don't think his actual intent was this way, but
yeah,
I'm more sort of offended by the photographer who sort of took the picture and framed it in such a way that we would think that that is
yeah,
their feelings. Although, I don't, you know, after reading his response right here, I don't think that's actually his intention.
Well, he practically bends over backwards in his editorial. They're like, I just took out my camera, I just tucked him away, I set him in a box and didn't look at them for 2 years. Somebody picked it for the cover of my book. I mean,
yeah,
it's, everything is just sort of like, it's not my fault.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if I believe him on every single one of those points, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The fact of the matter is, I think that there was an intent not to want to have this photo released, because it's an indictment, this photograph is. And it's an indictment of like 3 or 4 different things. It could be an indictment of the people in this photograph. To that degree, the indictment is of a generation, I think, youth.
Yeah.
You know, it is an indictment of youth on that day who do not know this. On the other hand, it is an indictment, perhaps, on people who live, New Yorkers, on Brooklynites to their Manhattan neighbors. I mean, it's an indictment on certain subsets of the American population. It could be an indictment of the photographer. How could someone take this picture? You know, that sort of thing. Such that I think part of us does think, like you said, I'm not sure I believe that these people were really feeling that way that day, but I can tell the good photographer took advantage of it. And it's an indictment on, most importantly, on who would have the audacity to publish this photograph or crop it or edit it in some way. Yeah.
So I went to high school 5 blocks away from the World Trade Towers,
mm-hmm,
and the window of the classroom where I was like looked out to the gaping hole of the first plane.
Yeah.
And I've taken a very similar photo.
Yeah.
Somebody asked me to.
Uh-huh.
Of a bunch of my classmates in front of this gaping hole.
Acting, and how were your classmates supposed to be acting? Just normal, or?
Well, that's the thing. Like, I saw the photo afterward, and
mm-hmm,
like, you know, I have to kind of all sink in. And I think that all the people in the photograph, as well as me who was taken it, like, were horrified that we were even
Yeah, having said that, this
but
is
But having said it, it did happen at the photograph.
I know, and I bet you there'd be a big... To see the gaping hole and to see people in a classroom, life goes on, as the guy said, is... It's a another kind of tragic photo. But I doubt the indictment is as strong in front of the gaping holes as it is in front of the burning building. Because, of course, life does go on. The thing that's insightful,
I mean,
about
this...
This
was, like, at 9-11.
On 9-11?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah. I mean, that one strikes as much more as the example.
I mean the gaping hole, like, as the building was still standing.
I think that example is that you mentioned is like the one that he mentions about the mother and the child on the top of the roof.
Mm-hmm.
I found it interesting that he wants to equate the child on the roof, or your example, which is, I think, equivalent to it, which are moments where life does go on, but this is life going on in leisure. You know what I mean? It's not the classroom. It's not a mother and her child, obviously. You know, we're not going to, you know, the world was rocked by this particular incident, but the world didn't stop. It kept spinning, so to speak. These people sort of are there's a leisure to the photo that speaks to its particular offense, but I think you're right. I think that there are many, many photographs like this in people's personal collections. And this is a good example. I'm glad you mentioned it. The photograph that you took is absolutely a photograph and has those same weights. This is media. If your photograph was published in your school newspaper even, then it would jump to a different sort of category, what have you, and it's about the audience that it's speaking to. Your hand was up.
I was going to tell a sort of similar story. And I grew up in the city, so I was in middle school when this happened, and I was not nearly as close as you were, so I'm glad that you're okay. But I find it hard to get upset about the photo.
Yeah.
You know, I can't blame someone for trying to disconnect themselves emotionally from a tragedy as it occurs.
Yeah. No, I mean, and that's why I think that the photo at the level of culpability and liability that happens here, it purports to be about the subjects in the photograph at first, but really that's just a small drop in the bucket compared to what would it mean to be the person that's disseminating this photo, that's anthologizing this photo, that's publishing it the day after the 9/11 happened, so to speak. I think you're right. The longer one looks at it even and lingers on it, the less I think we feel insightful at the people in the photograph, you know, in the sense that I think we're aware of the very manipulable things that photographs can do. Yeah.
Well, if you look at the way she's sitting in the bike, I think that's what makes you look at it and say it's a leisure scene.
Yeah.
But if you actually look at everybody's faces, there's nobody smiling, like they're looking at each other, and I mean, I could just as easily be convinced that they're sitting there saying, wow, look at what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is that it's not what their faces have, it's what their faces are missing. Most of the expressions we expect to see on 9/11 photography on the day is anguish, shock, awe. If one of them had their mouths agape, the entire photo would change. Just that little bit of part of the image would change. So in some ways, it's not what's in the photo that's upsetting, it's what's not in it in some way. But I liked your fact about the bike. I think that's a great example. You take the bike out, just take the bike out, and that even changes the photo a little bit, you know? Anybody else? Thoughts? Yeah.
I think something else that's missing, if we put this photo into context now, is that no one's whipping out their smartphone to get in.
Right.
And given the time span, you know, I remember on that day sitting in high school, and you know, I remember our TVs lit up, there was smoke coming out, you know, the buildings, and our teacher had said, oh, you know, well, I think there might have been a fire or something. And she shut off the screen and went back to teaching the lesson. So that day, you know, media in itself was completely skewed. So
yeah.
Maybe, honestly, these people could have said, you know, Jesus, I don't know what happened over there.
I'll tell you, that's what I mean. I think a large part of what we saw that day, most of us experienced and saw, was people glued to television and the internet. And I moved to Philadelphia on 9/11, that very, very day. So I had all my stuff in it, and I was moving into a high-rise downtown. They wouldn't let me move in. Everybody has their own story. My point was that I didn't have a computer set up. I didn't have a smartphone at the time. And, of course, I didn't have a TV set up. So I heard the whole day on radio. The whole day, you know? So I never actually even saw images of it, really, until the newspapers came out the next day. So, but to think of seeing people not attached to any kind of media in some way is also what's kind of troubling about this particular photograph. They seem to be eyes averted from what's happening right behind them, but we are comforted in some way by knowing that people at a tragic event, that they are at least captivated by the event that's happening. If not in person, which they're not here, then certainly through media. And again, another absence in the photograph. Yeah?
From this picture, someone can predict the position of these people within their society. People know their social background, like, are they minorities? Or how do they value themselves as compared to those people in these buildings which they are burning, the society at large? So, you may come with a conclusion which might not be right.
Yeah.
They feel like you are not part of this society, which is.
Mm-hmm. No, and this is one of the things that comes with images like that, in that we get a certain amount of meaning from it, and we also have to project a certain amount of meaning onto it, which is to say, this is where we enter. Who are these people? What are they doing? The hard thing about this, and if those of us remember this, if we were in the States at the time, I mean, although it was said internationally too, you know, we all became New Yorkers on that day, was the thing that was sort of said in a way that was a message of solidarity, is what that was supposed to be. We all had sympathy with the people who were perished in that incident. And in this photograph, we actually see people in New York and not living up to that very mantra, so to speak, that was set out. You ready to begin?
Yeah, I was just going to say that I'm almost more offended when people are so captivated and ravenous for disasters and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, for years after this, I couldn't go anywhere and say I was from New York before people ask me, like, oh, were you in the city on 9/11?
Of course.
Tell me about it. You know,
yeah, of course.
It was a personal experience with that. Like,
yeah.
It was, It's just like, can you just let me move on?
Yeah.
Like, seriously.
I'm sure in your case it hasn't. And all of us at the time probably shortly after just sort of got fatigue from all of it. You know what I mean? Which is interesting. Media has an important function like any kind of discourse sort of does, where does attention cross the line into over-attention, you know?
When news was half an hour every night, you know, there was enough to fill it where you could have meaningful discussion. But when you're running 24 hours a day and all of a sudden it's just like, you know, let's go slow play-by-play footage of a guy jumping out of a burning building is disgusting.
Well, and that's a line that each of us has for what's disgusting or isn't about the media attention. And that's the thing about media attention, too. The over-infatuation or over-attention on a particular subject can feel like it is doing an ethical disservice to the people involved. On the other hand, there's a line on the other side of the spectrum where there's not enough attention or just scant attention is paid, in which case it doesn't seem like it is doing a suitable tribute, if you will. So for every person that said, we are covering 9/11 way too much on the news every night because we're making a spectacle out of it, there was probably a whole host of people saying, we are not giving this event the attention that it deserves. And it's the context, the audience, the timing, the proximity that affect all these things. But your frustration, I guess I could say, at that is not unique, I think, in particular. And it's not unique to 9/11 or New Yorkers either. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Sorry.
I think one of the things that made this photograph so kind of controversial is that when Frank Rich wrote this column, I remember reading it, he said that they weren't being callous. He said that they were just being American. And some people took a lot of offense at that because it was equating an entire nation of people to this particular group, and especially when it came into international media. That's when people took arms and said, no, I'm an American, I'm not like this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder, had this photographer just published his photos quietly, and Frank Rich had put up his column.
Down the hall. Yeah.
Frank Rich had not written this column in the New York Times, most of all, you know, one of the biggest media outlets in the world. Then do you think this photograph would have been that big of a deal, to
no, no doubt it became a lightning rod issue because it became a lightning rod issue because of the fact that it didn't just appear in such a prominent newspaper, it had premiered in the flagship New York newspaper too, you know. And then, like I said, one could take this photograph as an indictment on New Yorkers in some way. That people, citizens of that very city, had the potential, even for a moment, to seem aloof on that day. Which, to be honest with you, who the hell can sustain being grieved and outraged and super attentive 24 hours even on that day? So the fact that they are capable of diverting their gaze for 5 seconds or whatever from the burning buildings, it can send a message that it's incendiary, whether it's when it's printed in a certain place in a certain time. And I think it's publication of the New York Times. And I think even Rich's comments were a testament to the fact that his column, I remember his column, it was very much at the level of wanting to absolutely honor the horror that could happen on 9/11, but also to really kind of say that American life goes on, and what Americans look like have not changed as a result. That didn't get destroyed. In many ways, I think his fascination with the photo was not so much that those persons looked callous and aloof, but they looked like they had been unharmed and damaged by the terrorist attacks that had happened that way, which is to say it was supposed to show that not everything got destroyed on that day. So there was almost a positive spin, and the positive spin is what I think sort of, how could you say that sort of thing? Yeah, absolutely. Any last thoughts on this photograph? It's clearly a lightning rod kind of issue, sort of photograph. But I put it out there because of the fact that while it is not health or clinical or medical related, what have you, there is clearly an ethics to this photograph, to the taking of it, to the looking at it, to the printing of it, to the dissemination of it. Our even reading of it is its own ethically fraught sort of relationship. And it's a good example of the kind of work that we're going to be doing semester long. Let's turn towards a different kind of imagery. And this one we're going to have you in groups. Make sure, Jamie, I give you one you haven't had before. These are public health posters. Is everybody familiar with the genre of the public health poster? Everybody? Okay, I'll explain that. The dates for when these came out are on the bottom right.
Oh my God.
There you go. And they're numbered because everybody's going to be put in a group to sort of come up with some insights on the poster. The public health poster as a genre really dates from the latter part of the 19th century. And here's a couple things to think about and take note of. Excuse me. They're usually published by institutional, municipal, or government sort of agencies. So, listen real quickly because you're going to need this for your group when you get into groups. To know where the image comes from is to also know that if it's a public health poster, it has a purpose at this level of servicing and educating a mass audience. Nationally, regionally, internationally, you name it. And there's always a message that has to go across too. It's essentially a teaching tool, a recruiting tool, or an instructional tool put out for the purposes of educating on some health-related matter. Quite often attached to values related towards patriotism or militarism or economics or culture or national pride or patriotism or something like that. So looking at your photograph, you're going to want to ask yourself, when did it come out? What historical situation informs what's happened? And visually, what is being done here? What is the language, the conversation that's happening in the words and the pictures in this image? What is it telling? What message is it sending? What message may it accidentally be sending? What does it mean to look at it in the context of its historical moment, and what does it mean to look at it in posterity? As I said, the questions I put down here, things to think about media, will help you in your group in looking at this photograph. We're going to break into groups now for about 15-20 minutes and have each group come up with a team sort of assessment, analysis of this particular image, and then we're going to come back together. As a media, then, one thing you're going to want to ask yourself, and if you don't know the answer to this, I'll be coming around to the groups, is where would I see this particular image? You can sometimes tell from what the photo, what the poster is, so I'm hesitant to tell you where these posters appeared. Instead, I'd like you to interpret, try to figure out where they came from. So, Jamie, I'm going to make you group number 3, and I'm going to count off for the rest of you. So 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3. Has everybody got a number? Good. So here's where the groups are going to break down. One group can stay in here. Let's have group number 1 in here. Group number 2 in the lounge. Group number 3, I want to come across the library. And group number 4, any suggestions?
The back corner.
Yeah, group number 4, want to come back there? Sure, that works. All right, so group 1, raise your hand if you're 1. Great, you're staying here. 2, raise your hand. 1, 2, 2, 2, 2. Great. Over in the conference room. 3s and 4s, follow me. And remind me when I come back in. Be back up. All right, so we're back to convene. Let's go around each of the groups and talk about these posters and what we think they have to say for us. If you've got that handout with you still, the one that says things to ask about media, or even the first one I gave you, just have that out next to us so we can refer to it and say, well, we talked about what the context of this image is and so on and so forth. But let's start with group 1. Who are group 1 people? Just a reminder. Okay, take it away, anybody from group 1?
All right, well, our first thoughts that this post, it was a poster that would be hung up at eye level. Probably 4 soldiers specifically. I mean, look at the 3 individuals, like 2 are clearly soldiers. The 1 in the middle, maybe not, but I mean, it could be a soldier in non-military garb.
Yeah.
So where we were thinking these were for soldiers overseas more so than individuals within the states at the time. Probably be in places where they would see it. We were thinking bathrooms would probably be, I mean, it's not too pleasant to have this image right smack on the wall. So maybe in the bathroom where they'd be sure to see it, but outside of the complete.
Who's making this image, you think? Like, who's putting it out?
The government.
The government. Like,
yeah, it would be, yeah. National Health Agency in particular. This one actually comes from the U.S. Army Corps Health Service, so to speak, so it's upset. So you're totally right about the fact that this is intended for soldiers, or we can say also for the man in the middle, recruiting of soldiers, too. So this is because even the date dates from the Second World War. So we're talking about, there's a draft going on here, so everybody's pretty much a part of the military arsenal. Carry on, though.
So it's portraying a wholesome, pretty, well-dressed, well-groomed female. Suggesting that it, you know, you can't tell by looking whether or not someone has these diseases. It's kind of to make her as nice looking as possible to cover all bases. You know, there's any, you know what I mean? Like, if there's any indication that she might be carrying the disease, oh, I'll just look for that. But she's
right. You know, so, how would you describe the woman here?
You said she was pleasant, homely.
Pretty, well-dressed, groomed.
Girl next door. Friendly. Girl next door, totally. You know, not the bombshell, you know, not the whatever, but she's just sort of, you know, she's very Donna Reed, you know, Donna Reed, very Donna Reed looking. Carry on.
So it's, I mean, she's not, I don't know exactly how prostitutes dress back then.
Not too different than now, except for maybe thong underwear and things like that, but still, think cleavage and tight dresses and things like that, yeah.
They also listed three categories. Prostitutes, self-explanatory. Pickups, I think, I mean, I don't know how the social norms were back then, but a pickup, I don't think you would go to a bar and then go home with someone. I don't think that was as socially accepted back then. So I think a pickup...
And so I would say it was less talked about rather than, but actually happening, you know, at the same time. And people had one-night stands that wasn't invented in the 70s, you know, but...
But I mean, it might not be as acceptable.
Sure.
To be a... I wouldn't call a girl who did that a pickup, really, today.
Oh, no, of course not.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
And good time girls,
we were trying to look up what it is, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's euphemisms and slangs for she's easy, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. We were trying to figure that out.
Yeah, but I mean, she doesn't look like a pickup girl or a whore or whatever. One of my favorite public health posters, and you may remember this, Jamie, if I can't remember, Jamie took a class with me a couple of years ago on sexuality and bioethics, and I used some public health posters at one point, and there was one that's my favorites from the same time period, and it's about telling people, soldiers basically, you know, don't get the same thing, contractive venereal disease, except in this case the woman is up there and she's like this seductive and she's got huge cleavage or whatever and it just says across the bottom, booby trap. I love it. This woman is not that woman. This is supposed to be like what you think of as a pickup girl, and a good pickups and a good time girl and a prostitute can come in different packages. Yeah, you can pull it up if you want, booby trap. It's very funny. In fact, let me see.
Is this it right here?
Uh-huh. Let me see.
Yeah.
Nice.
Booby trap. Public health, is that right? Oh, there she is. Booby trap.
And there's the other one right
there. I know, right there, right behind it.
We found a bunch of them, yeah. Like men who know.
No, this is a very prominent genre of public health poster. The poster that's intended for soldiers not to get venereal disease. In fact, it's one of the foundations of the public health poster as a genre. Public health really dates from the 19th century as an organized, governmental-run agency institution really from the turn of the century. And one of the first places that this kind of imagery is used for educational purposes is absolutely in the service of making sure venereal disease isn't spread. Now, what is the function of this poster then, quite frankly, do you think?
It's to get the soldiers to not sleep with women they meet while in service. We're saying that it's not just do that and you'll get sick, but do that and you will be doing a disservice to your country.
Yeah, and I think this is also used for recruiting. So this would appear in military recruiting offices. It would have probably appeared at places where people had to sign up for the draft or not, that kind of thing. And it certainly would have appeared in any military sort of organization, overseas and domestically as well. If you can read, it's kind of faintly here at the bottom. You can't beat the Axis if you get VD is what's being said here. The idea is that this is a message that wasn't disseminated just to soldiers and would-be soldiers. It was actually one that was meant to disseminate quite vast. One of the things to note historically in hand was if you contracted a venereal disease, you were discharged from the military, dishonorably discharged from the military. The idea being that these diseases weren't quite as under control as they can be now, and that idea was that you are failing not just your own health, but your country. So if to contract a venereal disease is to take one more soldier away from the cause and the fight that our country needs. So one's health actually becomes an example of whether you're being patriotic or not. That's why the stakes of this particular image are about making sure that one comes home physically fit and morally clean was the phrase that was quite often used in World War I advertising, when the advertising was even morbid, antiquated, so to speak. Anybody else, thoughts about what's going on in this image, things that you see here that are interesting from that group or beyond? I can tell you my favorite thing about this is the fact that the men are standing there, and look at the size of that woman, right? I mean, she is dwarfing these men, right? That's the menace that this is. If she is the face, quite literally the poster child for syphilis and gonorrhea, it has the magnitude and the power to dwarf the U.S. military, is basically what's being said here. At a time when we're trying to pump up the invincible American forces, so to speak, we know that there are things that can defeat it, and it's not just Hitler and Hirohito, it's something like a venereal disease that's sort of happening here. One of my other favorite ones, too, at this time is that one that has a slogan that says, you can't beat the axis if you don't use prophylaxis. That's what it says. Yeah, so I mean, they're all, but these ways in which to render patriotism and the military cause and public health is synonymous. All of these things sort of have the same sort of purpose. But it's an absolute, you could go online and Google the venereal disease public health poster and you're going to find hundreds of examples. It's particularly, and it's, hey, I've done it. It's totally interesting. It's totally absolutely interesting. Any last thoughts on this one?
I wonder who the poor woman is.
I know, right? She probably thought she was advertising for like Duncan Hines or something, right? And then they slapped it on here, you know? You know that's what happened, remember? I think she probably quite literally is some sort of composite of like June Allison and Donna Reed and like some other, you know. I bet you if you went to Central Casting in Hollywood in 1942, they had an image just in their file. We want this one, you know what I mean? She's like a Central Casting sort of figure, so to speak. But yeah, I would be curious to know who the actual grandma!
My first job.
That sort of moment. Okay, group number two, jumping ahead here to 1985. Who's our group number two people? Great. Somebody want to take it away?
Sure. So, I mean, the audience given the picture is very specific. This is obviously for, you know, your average married white male with having bisexual affairs. And by whom, you know, we can see that it's a public health outreach. So it looks like it's a public health department, probably powered by the CDC at this point.
Mm-hmm. This one says in New York City Department of Health.
Yep. And then, to what effect? So, moving from here, what we do is we just broke down the context of this and the language of this, and we realized that this, the way that this is constructed, is pretty much language that's built around the health belief model, and that it's a reflection of the change in the perception that no longer was HIV/AIDS just in the gay population, because at this point in the 1980s, you know, the public health department started to realize it wasn't gay cancer anymore, that it was actually an epidemic, and that they wanted to address it in very different ways. And so, we analyzed the text and realized, for example, you know, Charlie always felt that his bisexual affairs were harmless enough, but Charlie did catch the AIDS virus. That's why his family's at risk. So right there, we begin to see that, you know, he's putting his family at risk. Then suddenly the language flips, you know, his wife risks losing her husband, so language flips again. And then it flips again, you know, when she has sex with him, you know, her own life. And then it leaves this idea of balancing fault. And it moves to, you know, if she becomes pregnant, the virus can be passed on to the baby. And so we see this idea of perceived guilt and perceived severity on multiple levels being balanced back and forth. Then the text moves down to the child care protecting himself, saying no would have done it, which is one option he could have been given. And then, or he could have used a condom. So here, it's not a condemnation, it's very much a statement of the fact that he is bisexual and he's having an affair, and either the risks and consequences that could come of it. And yes, we know what he could have done, but there is an alternative. And so here, you know, isn't your anti-American by having sex with a prostitute, you need to get a BT. It's like, okay, we know that this is going on, here are some potential options. One of the things that we also talked about was the reality that this poster honestly could have relevance today, right? Because not much has changed. I mean, you know, it will no longer be called an AIDS of case, a case of AIDS, it would just be an HIV infection, because, you know, we're starting to realize, you know, the reality that people are HIV infected versus just being flat out having AIDS. But the reality is this poster has great relevance today. If you pick up any public health journals or you read the CDC surveillance report, you realize that, you know, HIV transmission is present in the men who have sex with men community, but actually it's really high among the heterosexual community, you know, it's, for example, among minority communities. You know, among men and women who have sex with each other is skyrocketing compared with like the MSM, the male to male group. And so we see this having relevance in the 1980s, and we definitely see it having relevance today. And in contrast with you know, the poster that we saw that group one had, we actually see here that, you know, this poster is developed with a great sense of thought, because they're actually using health, you know, health behavior models to construct the messaging that appears into here. They added a poster that adds a sense of relevancy. You can see this man's a very much a family man, that he's going home from work with groceries for his wife, right? And so to hear that he might be also bringing home along with the groceries AIDS, it's terrifying. And we can see why guilt would work and why this poster is, like, quite frankly, quite effective.
Mm-hmm. Good. I like that you were touching on some of the ways in which, how would that be different if it sort of came out now? I think the bisexual part would be sort of a moot point, in the sense that we're talking about a pretty small subset of people these days if we're talking about married heterosexuals who occasionally have bisexual affairs, compared to just straight people, gay people, young people, that kind of thing, the larger groups. Having said that, we are in an era here in 1985 when we're still quite often associating homosexuality with it, so this element of bisexuality comes in here. Thoughts about the headline, the tag, the headline that sort of starts it off. The other night, Charlie brought home a quart of milk, a loaf of bread, and a case of AIDS. I mean, it's definitely an underlining of AIDS, you know, on the sign. What do you make of that genre, the pitch of that particular slogan?
You have to have a certain level of interest to read it, because it's a lot of text.
It's a lot of text.
And there's not anything that visually grabs
you. There is, and I've told you this is the strategy used for a public health poster for a good way. And that is, you take a public health poster, and you put it up on the wall, and imagine if it was full size, and you walk past it, and you just give it one of these. Imagine the poster's over here. Like that. Just give it, what would have caught your eye in that short moment? So in this one, it would have been the sight of Donna Reed and the word syphilis and gonorrhea. What? You know, this one it could be the movie and just syphilis and if you're a tits man. You know, it could be any of those things. You know what I mean? This one, though, what's the thing that gets you in a moment?
Of AIDS.
In fact, I would go even more specific. It's the proximity of AIDS to the image of the man below it, which is to say, this is an image, if you take the picture out, of like, honey, I'm going to get a quart of milk, you know, that kind of like dutiful sort of like husband carrying home the groceries, you know, and to see AIDS next to that picture, I think, is particularly the thing that might, in that historical moment, seem like it'd be unusual or suspicious or whatever, since we're largely expecting to see AIDS next to pictures of prostitutes and heroin and drug addicts and homosexual men or whatever. So to see what purports to be a sort of straight old hetero sort of grocery shopping man and the word AIDS next to it is sort of the jargon thing. The headline of it, if the purpose of this one, if what would you say is the tone of this of the slogan here? She may look clean, but da-da-da spread syphilis and gonorrhea. I mean, I think it has its own form of menacing, if you will, you know? Whereas this one is like, ba-dum-bum-psh, you know, that's sort of like rim shot, you know, right? I mean, it's informative, but it gets you with the humor, too. We all laughed when we saw it. And this one is like terror. You know, I think is what it's supposed to be. In a way that if you've studied horror films or genres related towards that particular thing, quite often the most terrifying sort of genre in a horror film is when it's coming from within the house, or it's happening in the suburb, or the summer camp, or places that we think of are idyllic suddenly become deadly. And this is a quart of milk, a loaf of bread, and a case of AIDS. I mean, we've really, what has been desanctified here isn't just the home. I mean, it's the innocence of the shopping list itself. That's sort of been, you know, AIDS lurks everywhere. You know, it's sort of what's sort of happening here. So that's the emotional register that we're getting for this particular thing. I like the thing you mentioned, too, about the fact that there's a shift that keeps happening between who is the protagonist, if you will, in terms of our sympathy in this particular text. Is it Charlie? Is it his wife? Is it this hypothetical baby that could be born one day, so to speak? The message and strategy in this message, though, is not entirely different, though, from those VD public health campaigns from the early 20th century. Those campaigns were in large part inspired to make sure soldiers were fit to serve, but they were also meant to just protect the health and sanctity of families at home. And in some way, that's very much what this ad is trying to do. It's not as much in the service of Charlie as it is it's sometimes Charlie's wife and his child. On the one hand, it's very progressive for its time for not saying, how could he have an affair, or how could he, you know, sleep with another man, or whatever. Instead, it's saying he could have said no, and he could have used a condom. Those are still largely the two ways that we have contention in AIDS public health discourse. Do we stress abstinence, or do we stress, you know, safe sex in some way, or what have you? So they're almost always, it's kind of interesting to see that now, 20-some years later, we're still negotiating that compromise between, do you say no, or do you use a condom? And that might be a enduring sort of public health concern with AIDS. But anyway, it's an interesting thing to note about this poster, the way that it's actually visually and stylistically rather bland, you know, if you will. But there's a lot going on stylistically, even the way it's shifting. Let's go to group number three. Group three, we get to Hitler. So take us away, somebody in group three.
Sure.
Yes.
Well, starting off with the last point you had, Lance, just kind of stylistically speaking, this is really in contrast to the last picture we saw, where there's a lot of blues and darker hues. You know, we've got very vivid colors here.
Yeah.
From the purple suit to the orange background. To even the invisible Hitler. You know, there's a lot of color within the scheme.
Mm-hmm. That's like a suit from like the Steve Harvey line. Right, isn't it?
Absolutely. But I think the biggest thing when looking at a poster like this is context.
Uh-huh.
So we're looking at 1943. Just being kind of a history guy, you look at World War II and its perception within the American public. In 1943, we're still ostensibly focused on the European theater. So
yeah.
We haven't really focused back to the Atlantic, or excuse me, the Pacific theater yet.
Yeah.
So our focus is still in Nazi Germany. And so they use Hitler as kind of this, I guess, visceral image of, you know, what the Axis stands for.
Mm-hmm.
Within that, during 1943, you've got rationing of rubber, plastic, and gasoline, all of which are used to construct automobiles, and the idea that any gas used aimlessly driving around is gas taken away from the soldiers. When soldiers don't have gasoline, they don't have rubber, they don't have plastic, well, they can't fight the Axis.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a conservation of resources and the way in which even excess use of fuel or not driving too much can be a part of that. Jamie?
Is this actually a public health poster?
It came from the same arsenal, the same the same group that did. This is a different sort of like
there's some
social
health
that's sort of happening here. But it's basically about saying, for example, there were ads that were from the same series that said, you know, when you smoke too much, you smoke with Hitler, you know, or when you don't use canned goods appropriately, you're dining with Hitler, or something like that. And this one just happens to be, when you ride alone, you ride with Hitler, you know what I mean? So it came out of a public health campaign, but you're right, this is, it seems to be, is this about cars? Like that kind of thing, yeah.
The other thing we were talking about is that he's this nicely dressed guy, and that there could be two ways you look at this. Is one, like, you're a guy and you're not at the war.
Yeah.
So this is the least you could be doing.
Of course.
And especially he's someone who's nicely dressed, maybe it's saying you're not above this.
Yeah.
But then the other thing that she was saying as well was, you could also say, well, there's a lot of things at this time where it's, you know, about community, we're all in this together. Most people are already really gung-ho about supporting the war. So maybe this is also partly a feel-good supportive ad for if you were doing it already.
Mm-hmm. It could be, yeah. I mean, one of the take-home messages from this or any of those other ones I mentioned that were part of the same series is we're all a part of the war effort. And this is one of the ways in which you contribute or can work against. In other words, this is not a ad that talks about incentive. It doesn't say, you know, join the car sharing club today, because you could actually be helping the boys overseas conserve on fuel. Instead, it's a chastising sort of, this is a stick, not a carrot kind of ad, you know? And to that end, what it's doing is sort of saying, we have a responsibility to conserve and be a part of the movement, and this ad is sort of taken away from that. And it's true, it's very bright. I think that in that sense, it's supposed to be optimistic in that sense. As much as the picture is kind of funny and a bit Hitler's in it, it's hard to make Hitler bright and optimistic. But I think that's part of the reason he's an outline, too, by the way, is the fact that the take-home line is really the second one at the bottom. Join a car-sharing club today. So if you did that same thing, Jamie, you did before, you cover the top of the bottom half. You cover the bottom half, and it seems like that is the right color scheme to have for this ad. You cover the car-sharing club thing, and it seems like, isn't that a little bit sunny for the message that's supposed to be there? So I think the color hues speak to the way in which this is an attempt to make sure that the ad chastises, but it absolutely inspires someone to go and do something. Any other thoughts about Hitler, who's very much like a Scooby-Doo kind of ghost sort of
image.
Figure, you know? He reminds me of like Wonder Woman's invisible jet, like how that's drawn, you know? He'd fit right in there. But why do you think that we have Hitler in particular in outline here? Anybody? As opposed to just drawing in Hitler. There are plenty of ads from this era that say things like, if you contract syphilis and gonorrhea, you're taking a toast to Hitler and Hirohito and Mussolini. And then there's a picture of a soldier toasting these three particular people. Those aren't good. They're actual figures. Yeah.
Jamie's getting at the idea of like the spirit of him. Like, I think he's emphasizing the spirit of Hitler being within that core. Like, the idea that... I guess it's kind of like just him being there physically.
Yeah, and Hitler's not actually going to be in the car with you, right? I mean, but it's as though he's there. Did I cut you off?
No. Yeah. Like, you could almost, like, will him away or will his actions away by doing this.
That's good. I like that. But he just sort of can disappear into the ether. I mean, another way this ad could have been drawn was that if it had a whole bunch of cars in traffic or something, and there were multiple Hitlers in all of these cars, then it would absolutely make sense that they would make this outline in that sense. Because that's the idea. The spirit of Hitler, the essence of him is with you if you fail to do this. Having said that, what's the walk by and take a glance at this sort of like thing? I mean, I suppose it's just either seeing Hitler in somebody's car with them is enough right there. But it's like the booby trap ad in the sense that it's also using humor, I think, you know. There's a chastising element to this particular ad, but there's whimsy, one might also say, too, in the way that it's presented. And being mindful of that exact pitch is to realize how this particular piece of media is working, what its agenda is. Let's turn to the last one. AIDS causes blindness. Group number four. Anybody?
Yeah, I can sort of summarize what we talked about. So, first of all, I guess when we just sat down and looked at this, we were kind of like, wow, this is such a ridiculous poster. I can't believe I don't feel this way. But then if you read the fine print in the bottom, it's the point that AIDS Action Committee is actually trying to convey is quite the opposite of what it seems at first.
What did you think it meant at first?
At first, it looks like what I would call like a hateful poster, in that they're trying to promote like segregation of the workplace and keeping mm-hmm. people with AIDS outside of work. But actually, as we sort of looked it up and thought more about what the AIDS Action Committee was trying to get across, what they're trying to get across is AIDS causes blindness, and that it's like people being ignorant.
Yeah.
Towards people who do have AIDS, so
mm-hmm.
that, you know, they're supposed to be mocking these people right in the middle of the poster, but it literally took us like, you know, 10 minutes of discussion to figure that out.
Yeah.
And there's no way if you did one of these walk by looks at it that's the point that would come across.
Well, in the sense, the one thing that would stand out is that you would look at this and what you would see is that you see a host of people from a variety of backgrounds here, absolutely, so black and white, young and old, blue collar and white collar. I mean, I think we're supposed to see all different sorts of things united. So that fusion of people is one thing, but under the banner of AIDS is probably part of what's interesting there. Any other thoughts about why? Because this is interesting. I mean, those of us who remember the time, it's not as though there were such things as people with placards walking around saying, I don't want AIDS in my school system or in my children's school or in my workplace or what have you. But that would have been an exception. It wouldn't have been like that was happening on every street corner. What's happening on every street corner, though, is there was a lot of discrimination towards people who had HIV and AIDS, and a lot of stigmatization of those particular individuals. To that end, the image that we have here is in some ways a historical truth. I mean, there were instances of people doing that. But the fact of the matter is that it's actually more of a representation of what it could be. It's okay. So to that end, what's the function of the image in the center of this picture?
And that's something we discuss at length about whether, so us viewing this picture now in our like preconceived notions of the 80s would be different than someone in the 80s seeing this poster and thinking,
yeah.
Oh, this would never happen. It must be a mockery of these people. Whereas when we saw it, like you could almost foresee that, oh, well, maybe this is just a picture of people congregating, or
yeah.
a picture of what people would like if they were congregating.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
It does make sense. Anybody else from that group or elsewhere have thoughts about the image in the middle? One of the things that's most savvy about this ad is the fact that seeing people walking around with placards that say AIDS on it at this time, most often, and even now most often, are people fighting for the rights of people who have AIDS. So part of what stands out here is, like, for example, the sign that has AIDS with, like, the Ghostbusters, like, symbol over it or whatever, you know what I mean? Like, it's this idea that we're seeing AIDS activism being associated with hate, not with the promotion and action. So most often, AIDS activism we see historically in photograph and print and media to be representations of people fighting for AIDS rights. And that would have been a huge issue in the mid-1980s, that people on the streets on a regular basis saying, help us, pay attention to us, fund us, do studies on us, that sort of thing. This is an ad that basically what it does is takes the traditional way we see a protest related towards AIDS and flips it. Instead of it having to be people protesting in honor of or in support of people with AIDS, it has them protesting against it. Which is to say that kind of stigma and that kind of shame and that kind of bias towards people who are seropositive is tantamount to this kind of rejection, if you will. So one of the things that catches one's eye, or at least would have at that time, would have been seeing an AIDS protest that looks like this. An AIDS protest that has old ladies on it, an AIDS protest that has this, you know, diverse cast of white and blue collar people, an AIDS protest that actually has hateful things to say about AIDS. Those would have been sort of unusual. So it would have at least caught someone's eye. The other thing that's really playful about this is, of course, the headline. Did you guys have any thoughts about AIDS causes blindness? Why they chose that slogan? Anybody at all?
I think they're trying to say that it causes blindness among those who are from the outside looking in on it, and kind of having their own preconceived notions of how it's transmitted, and how they treat those that have it.
That's right, absolutely.
They're blind to the actual facts.
So on the one level, it means that AIDS causes a cultural stigmatizing kind of blindness on the way that, you know, that, and which is to say that AIDS affects a lot of people who don't have AIDS, and how it affects them is the way they see persons who are seropositive. The pun on this, of course, is what is a historical fact in 1987 was the fact that there were a high percentage of persons who were seropositive when they eventually contracted AIDS, often literally became blind. They contracted retinitis. So AIDS literally causes blindness, and AIDS metaphorically causes blindness is sort of what the poster is sort of grooving on in this moment. To that end, AIDS causes blindness would have been a common refrain of people who knew people who were seropositive because of the fact that it was one of the side effects of the disease at that time. However, to see it manipulated in a different context, a different way here, is to say this image has the ability to pitch and speak to different audiences in different ways for that reason. And most public health posters are like that. They tend to have multiple audiences in mind. Thus, like the one up on the screen, pun is a very common device that is used in these because that is what the definition of pun is, multiple meanings. Yeah.
So we were wondering in the group how this could have been misunderstood so easily by people who don't read fine print.
Mm-hmm.
Because like everything above the fine print is hateful and discriminatory. And these people in this poster look like your neighbors, right?
Yeah.
And how, you know, in the 80s, a lot of misinformation and a lot of ignorance about AIDS and... you know, like whether this poster could have been sending a hateful message to those poor editors.
Well, I can tell you this. It was not one of the most widely disseminated of posters at that time. In fact, I found that it was disseminated by this AIDS Action Committee of Boston, but a lot of other ones, I haven't seen it in a lot of other places. So, for example, the one about the bisexual dad guy or whatever, it's put up by the New York Department of Health, but you could go to a different city in the United States and all that would be different at the bottom is it would say, you know, the San Francisco Department of Health or something. So a lot of these come out of centralized locations like the CDC or the NIH and then are marketed or steered towards specific audiences. This one I've only seen in that Boston area. And one has to question then what kind of places was it put up. I would imagine one would have to be very strategic about making sure that this wasn't put up at church, you know, or something like that, you know, that it was put up in a place where someone had the leisure and the time with which to read the fine print. Because the fine print is actually pretty straightforward. Don't discriminate, don't be judgmental, allow people to be able to come to your workplace. The place you would have, number one, probably seen this would have been in the waiting room of a clinic, which case, you know what we all do in the waiting room of a clinic. Sit there and read everything we can to pass the time. That's where you would have seen it the most, yeah.
I mean, the literacy level is pretty high. So
it is.
This is at least what, 8th, 9th grade?
Yeah.
So it would have been targeted a particular part of Boston?
It would. The literacy rate would have been pretty high, so that suggests it might have been targeted towards, at the very least, a certain education level, or maybe a certain kind of university campus or something like that, a health center, a student center. And also the fact that the message at the top is so jarringly different, and that it's quite subtle, too, in the way that it's working in the messages above. So I imagine that it lends itself to not quite being disseminated en masse the way that some of these others could. Somebody else had their... Okay, any other thoughts on this poster? Yeah.
I have one last thought on this poster in particular and the fact that it was disseminated in Boston. When I first saw it, it reminded me of this picture, which I can't find now, of during the Boston busing crisis, which is when they desegregated the Boston high schools, and there was a lot of backlash and a lot of really hateful-looking people from they're all white, but they're all walks of life. And I'm sure in the 80s, you know, they look back at that as was such a gross, disgusting time. And then mm-hmm. I'm not sure if that was maybe somehow trying to be captured with this poster that, we look at these people who are, offensive to people with AIDS, you know, in the future we might think of that as a very offensive, disgusting time.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting... And we started with the first, but for the second poster, so we're asking what would it be like to see this ad updated, and this ad would be significantly different if it was released today, not least of which the fact that retinitis is quite rare for people who have AIDS. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Also, you know, I think when you look at a lot of different posters, it's often in response or in action or I think it plays off something currently in the media, and I think this is, given the timeline, probably all coming out of the issues that were put forth during the whole struggle with Ryan White.
Mm-hmm.
Because remember when Ryan White was in school, people would show up at his school with
pickets like this. That's the most common place where you'd see that kind of example. Yeah. So the picketing of people to keep AIDS out at this literal level most often happened at schools, in elementary schools at that. And Ryan White is just the headline example. If everyone's familiar with Ryan White, he was a boy in Indiana, I think, or someplace like that, that was not allowed to be enrolled in the public school because he was HIV positive. They had decided to make him, I think, learn from home or something like that. And his parents outraged, and Michael Jackson, Elton John, all these people came along, and eventually the boy was able to go to school. But it was this was a common scene in that particular time, and so this is taking it to a more professional level, I guess, instead of out of schools. Any other thoughts? Okay, we've got about 10 minutes. So what I want to do is pass this out, and go. Pass this out. And what I want to do is I'm going to email you a link. Attach this. This is what everybody knows about what this is going on right now. The latest thing in the news with the video that was put on YouTube promoting that movie, the anti-Islam movie, Innocence of Muslims, and the fact for all the protests that are happening in the Middle East right now. What I'm going to do is I'm going to send to you a link, and what I'd like you to do is look at it at some point. It's a 3-minute news clip from the BBC. What I want you to do is take a look at it between now and next week, and the first thing we'll do when we come in is just talk about that news clip and what it has to say about the event. Because basically, it's so timely, it's worth talking about, and it's so related to our class. But I want to sort of introduce it at the level of thinking about some of the problematic things we talk about when we're not talking about media, the way that it's very embedded and loaded. So in the case of that news story, what is it, and make a note to yourself, to watch this report about this event, so to watch a piece of media about an event that is in response to a media site, YouTube, posting another piece of media of this film promotion that somebody put out, which is to say it's this very layered sort of way. So if the first thing we looked at today was that photograph, where we feel like it's the accountability with the photographer or with the editor or with the people in the photo. This scenario that's happening right now in the news seems to speak to us is the accountability with the director who made the film, the actors who were in it, the person, the company that edited it, YouTube for putting it online, for BBC for covering it in incendiary and international ways and making it even more so, or where does the ethical quandary lie in terms of who has the culpability or the agency in this particular moment ethically? So this is just a short article. If you don't know much about this issue, it's 2 pages that basically says this is what happened, this is where the story is, and that sort of thing. The last thing I'd like us to do, though, is a piece of radio footage. This is actually, is everybody familiar with the Hindenburg disaster that happened when this is in 1937? The Hindenburg was a Zeppelin, a giant blimp that traveled throughout the United States and yes, Germany and stuff. And but it famously that you can see violently exploded, caught a flame when it was landing at a dock in New Jersey. And what happened was photographs took, as you can see here, images of the Hindenburg. There's one full-size image of the Hindenburg as it hit the landing station. Apparently a spark ignited inside of it and set it alight. But it was famous because, and witness to those moments was not just photographers, but there was radio covering it live to say, and the Hindenburg is about to land. And I just want us to listen to that for a few minutes to see what is it like without, in the absence of visuals,
the ship is riding majestically.
But with audio to hear. And audio itself is its own form of media. So let's just listen and imagine what is informed or not informed by the absence of image and the testimony of just the voice of the person here in this moment as radio technology.
Tortoise, like some great feather, riding the sword, was mighty proud of a place of playing in the world's aviation. The ship is no doubt bustling with activities. We can see orders are shouted to the crew. The passengers are probably lining the windows, looking down the field ahead of them, getting a glimpse of the mooring mast. And these giant flagships standing here, the American Airlines flagships, waiting to rise into all points in the United States when they get the ship moored. There are a number of important persons is on board, and no doubt the new commander, Captain Max Frisch. is thrilled too, for this is his great moment, the first time he's commanded the Hindenburg. For in previous flights, he acted as a chief officer under Captain Lehman. It's practically standing still now. They've dropped ropes out of the nose of the ship, and it's been taken a hold of down on the field by a number of men. It's starting to rain again. The rain had flashed up a little bit. The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from... It bursts into flame!
It bursts into flame and it's falling, it's crashing. Watch it. Get out of the way. Get this, Charlie. It's crashing terrible. Oh, my. Get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast, and all the folks between that this is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's 400 or 500 feet into the sky. It's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now, and the frame is crashing to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. Oh, the humanity and all the passengers screaming around here. I told you, I can't even talk to people. There's prisoner out there. I can't talk, ladies and gentlemen. Honestly, it's just laying there a massive smoking wreckage. And everybody can hardly breathe and talk and screaming. Lady, I'm sorry. Honestly, I can hardly breathe. I'm going to step inside while I cannot see it.
And now, friends, I want to tell you, I'm back here, I want to tell you that the wreckage is still flaming out there, but I have some very good news for you. I just came from the front of the building where they have set up an emergency station, and they claim that between 25 and 30, that is the estimate, between 25 and 30 are saved out of the wreckage. Now, I have here a total of 39 passengers and 61 crew. That would make an even 100, but they tell me there were about 106 on board, so that makes 35 out of, between 25 and 30 out of 106 so far saved and accounted for, that is what they have been identified.
Okay. Let's just take a few minutes. Obviously, they talk much faster at the beginning of that, didn't they? I think that's a testament to the fact that this was just some run-of-the-mill local journalist that was there covering the docking of the blimp that had probably been there many times before because there was a permanent docking station. So, you know, but suddenly had to turn to emergency news action reporter on the spot, so to speak. Let's talk about, first of all, about what it is to look at, to listen to. They had some video footage, I guess it turns out. At first, I thought it was just going to be a couple of photographic stills. You know how YouTube is. But the person who was recording the footage and the person who was doing this stuff were not from the same news agency, so someone just spliced them together. Thinking about that radio testimony, first of all, what are some things that seem particularly informative and thinking about what effects does it have and what attention? How would you read that radio news broadcast? What things are of interest to you as a piece of media? Its content, of course, is part of it. What else? Yeah.
The tone of voice of that was something terrible was happening.
Yeah. I mean, that's a perfect thing to mention and to say that one of the things we have to pay attention to when it comes to the genre of radio technology or audio technology is in the absence of visuals, we happen to have a few, but the guy who was doing the broadcast wasn't with that team. How does one's audio commentary or voice have to compensate, you know? Of course, when we watch radio, if you've ever listened to radio programs or what have you, like they appeared back in the pre-TV era, or if you hear them now, there's often a lot of sound effects and things like that, you know? BBC is here talking about the newest news, and you hear babbling brooks in the background, chirping, that kind of thing, you know? They have to render, stimulate us to have visualized things in our head that we're not being provided by the media. But in this case, it's a lot of it is the tone of the voice that's happening here. If any of you have ever had experience of listening to baseball games or basketball games being commentated on over the radio or something, and the ball is going to the left, and it's going to the hoop, and it goes off the rim, and one more time, and he's carving off his brow, and it's a tough shot for him. And now they're running down the field, two on man action, that kind of thing, you know? They have to give us the play-by-play. But part of that's the pitch and the register and the tone. In this case, it's all coming from authentic, extemporaneous sort of response to a news event that's happening before this guy's eyes. What I want to ask you last about, and just to think about really quickly before we leave, is at the level of what's worth reading in that particular moment, hearing the Hindenburg disaster happen, if you all could just share with me a couple of minutes what it felt like in this room to listen to that. Where is the ethically problematic thing, not just inside the media itself, but our listening to it and our watching? It's very much the question of what is at hand in this case of what's happening in the Middle East, but how do people feel having to hear that news account?
I think
did it seem, I mean, to be honest, it seemed awkward, or it seemed like it was melodramatic, or I mean, or tragic? Anybody?
I feel like it was like his private reaction. We were all privy to it, like we were all listening to it, and he just kind of like had this emotional outpour.
Yeah.
Like we were just listening to it.
It's funny, and it got more and more that way, which is to say at the beginning, I think, in other words, I bet we could chart narratively our association with that news broadcaster. The first 30 seconds, we were all sort of like, Jesus, this guy talks fast, right? We could have given two shits to that. I would have turned the dial if I could have, right? Then the tragedy happens, and we're sort of amazed at how what's happening, how he's responding. And then it goes on about 20, 30, 40 seconds of him clearly breaking down, these gentlemen, thank and talking or whatever, and suddenly the man that we couldn't stand the first 20 seconds is now somebody our sympathies have moved and changed, because the genre of what this news piece was changed when the accident happened, and so did the intention, the way we read it and appreciated it. And to that degree, even within 2.5 minutes of one piece of media, our relationship with it and the stakes attached to it changed entirely. And my point is, it doesn't have to be something the level of the Hindenburg to stimulate that kind of change. Sometimes it can be something quite subtle that does that for us. Any last thoughts on that or about questions from today? I'll have the readings up online with the revised syllabus, but for next week, know that you're also supposed to just take a look at this BBC thing. If you absolutely can't get to it, don't worry about it. We'll probably watch a little snippet in class. But I'd like to start with just a short discussion about what's going on in the world right now, and it's all sparked by digital media. So let's talk about that, and then we're going to begin our sort of history of technology session. So thanks, everybody.
Thank you.